Welcome to Best Picture This, where it is always Oscar season. I'm Mike.
And I'm Brian. In this show, we reevaluate every Best Picture nominee from the 21st century and decide whether to keep it or kick it from its Oscar pedestal.
And if you kick this one, well, that's just like your opinion, man. The movie, Crazy Heart. The director, Scott Cooper. Here's the trailer.
Mr. Blake, I'm Gene Craddock from The Sun Scene. Tape recorder okay?
Go ahead, that's right.
What's your real name?
I'm Bab Blake. My tombstone will have my real name on it. Until then, I'm just gonna stay bad.
Your heart's on the loose. You rolled them sevens with nothing to lose.
Where'd all those songs come from?
Life, unfortunately.
Please. For the
weird kind. I'm 57 years old. I'm broke.
Why don't you sit down and write some songs, huh?
Keep talking.
You called all your shots.
I keep feeling obliged to apologize for being less than you probably imagined me to be.
Somehow this don't feel like home anymore.
We ought to go out and find some trouble to get into.
Yeah, big trouble.
And this ain't no place for the weary kind.
I knew what the risks were with you, and I took them.
This ain't no place.
It's one hell of a song.
This is gonna be your best year in the last seven.
Never too late, son. Never too late.
Pick up your crazy heart and give it one more try.
Coming out. So good to be home. One more try.
Would you go to a concert with Colin Farrell and Jeff Bridges singing country songs?
I would.
I totally
would. I think
would.
I would.
I think I would. all right. So Jeff Bridges did indeed win the best actor for this movie. It was also won for best achievement in music. Written for motion pictures, the original song, The Weary Kind, that you just heard. Maggie Gyllenhaal was also nominated for Best Supporting Actress. So the movie was written and directed by Scott Cooper, directorial debut. T-Bone Burnett, who helped write The Weary Kind, was also a guitarist for Bob Dylan in the 70s. And he worked on the music for Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Ah.
Robert Duvall, is he good in everything?
Yeah.
He's kind of similar, but he's pretty darn good.
Yeah, he does always kind of play Robert Duvall, but I like it.
I like it too. It was made for $7 million, made $47 million in the box office. The film was produced originally for country music television show. Then it was acquired for Paramount Vintage for a direct-to-video release, but Fox Searchlight Pictures swooped it up and put it on the big screen.
Wow. And then got Bridges.
Yep.
if actually, Bridges was not in this, though, I could totally see it as a TV movie.
Yeah, I think he was in it from the beginning, but I could be wrong. So let's do some questions, some trivia, some keep it or kick it.
You notice that the very first scene here, we started a bowling alley, and he even says...
The dude!
Yeah.
I know.
He
that's
goes, ugh, like, bowling alley, while he's dumping out his gallon of pee.
That's what I kept thinking about at the beginning.
There's got to be an in-joke.
Sam Elliott should have been there.
Definitely. All right. So the comparisons, other than to the Big Lebowski, are to the wrestler. Here. I think those are pretty obvious. Sure. These are both character studies anchored by strong lead performances. They're both stories about aging legends who have hit hard times. They both try to be redeemed, these characters, by a woman, and then ultimately find that their real love is their craft. For me, though, this movie didn't contain the revelations of Aid the Wrestler or the emotional power. And I'm curious if you had that same experience, and if so, what does the wrestler have that Crazy Heart does not have?
It's a good question. I think that I agree that The Wrestler is more impactful of a movie. But that was one of the best two or three maybe of the year. I think that besides the fact that he's mumbling a lot and it's hard to understand,
Mickey Rourke does some mumbling. He does some mumbling too. Says.
I think, I don't know. I guess some of it is, it feels a little predictable.
Yeah.
At times. And that's
that'd be my biggest.
That's part of the issue. But I do think that there is a really great moment that hits me pretty well in this movie. And that is when, you know, he gets sober and it's kind of like the montage, the montage is like, okay, but when that's done and then he goes to her house, you know, having the camera trained on Jeff Bridges in that moment, there's so much going on. And I think that's why he is, at least in the, I don't know if he should have won best actor for the movie, but this shows what he's got, you know, he is going to her house, trying to make amends, apparently hopeful that he would be able to turn things around and get back together with Maggie Gyllenhaal. And when she says no, the look in his eyes, the hurt, but also he's so reserved because he doesn't want to hurt her back for having, you know, he kind of knows, and he probably knew, he probably should have known all along that that wasn't going to solve the problem with her. And that, you know, he could not make up for what he did losing her, losing his, her son temporarily. But that, I think all that stuff happening in one little door scene for just like, you know, a few looks, I think was very impactful. I think that's kind of the emotional heart of the movie. You know, I think you kind of are, again, he's so down and out. I found myself rooting for him, hope, you know, trying to see, have some success with it and make amends somewhat with Colin Farrell's character.
You know, he's gonna,
you know, he will,
you know, he's gonna.
But, and again, that's part, that's one of the, it's a little too easy. Like,
oh yeah,
he's not really, there's no tension between him and Tommy Sweet. They're the Colin Farrell's character. They're just like, Colin Farrell is like, he wants him back all along. And what really changes his mind, it's like, I don't know, he just kind of needed the money a little bit more than he thought. So he decided to write some songs after all. And so I don't know. There's a lot of like kind of a little too easy resolutions.
Yeah. I think it's all a little too easy, a little too predictable. The Wrestler has that dark, surprising ending.
Yes, it does.
But I do like that Jeff Bridges was nominated for this. Whether or not he should have won, I don't know. But I think
we'll find out in our finale episode if he should have.
Yeah, I think so. But I do think he's great in it. And with The Wrestler, the same as with this, I feel like I could watch either of these characters kind of do anything, and it's still interesting to me because of how good they are. But some things here that I think are the differences. The relationship between Mickey Rourke and Marissa Tomei, A+.
Super fascinating.
Here, him and Maggie Gyllenhaal, I never understood what was going on in this relationship. I never understood what she saw in him, why she was hanging around. What did this guy bring to the table? Except for he was famous at one point, but she doesn't seem impressed with that at all.
No, she wasn't that. I mean, yeah. The fact that she wanted to interview him, you could see that, you know, she was impressed by his fame, but
yeah,
he's so, I mean, he's playing in the bowling alleys. He has no money. He's sleeping in bad motels, you know?
Like, yeah. You know that he's going to mess it up with her kid the minute that he starts to take on a little bit of responsibility.
Yep.
And you brought up the, you know, hitting rock bottom rebound.
The montage.
And this is about a fake person, but it's still, it follows the biopic form to a T. And it's even worse, though. I was thinking about Ray and Walk the Line.
Because it's fictional? Does that make it kind of worse?
Because of how quickly they fast forward through these, okay, we hit rock bottom, we're in hard times thing. I mean, he goes to AA, and then he's just out of AA. And, you know, a smash cut.
I want to get sober.
And then he just says, yeah, I think I have this thing licked. And he does. And that's it. Like, problem solved. I thought that was just kind of insane. But the ending was another part that kind of rubbed me the wrong way. I want to talk about that for a second. Because I loved the scene at the end where he kind of accepted he's not going to get Maggie Gyllenhaal back. And we just see him at home on his stoop sitting on the stairs and he's strumming. And it's kind of this idea that art is his redeemer and that's kind of enough. Mm-hmm. Loved it. It's like, movie's going to end here. Fantastic. But it doesn't end there. It ends with him going to a concert and somebody paying him $10,000 that apparently he's so successful now, he doesn't even need. And that he could just give to somebody else.
That was the other kind of hilarious, like, kind of like cheap writing part is like, when are you going to give the guy the 10 grand?
Mm-hmm.
Backstage during the concert while he's playing the song? Like, no, come on. That's not when you're going to pay the bills.
Yeah.
But it's just like, that's where they happened to be. That was the most, you know.
They wanted to be like at Red Rocks. Dramatic. It's a good looking place. Yep. And man, he's in such a good place right now. He could just give away 10 grand just like that. And if it just would have ended at the stoop with him strumming, I think I really would have,
felt
it.
Lonely man.
Yeah.
It's interesting. So in the book, Bad Blake actually dies of a heart attack. This is based on a novel.
Okay.
And the writer was Thomas Cobb, and he had a writing teacher who's very famous, super postmodern, really interesting guy, very influential, Donald Barthelme. And he's talking about, like, should I go happy or sad on this ending? Donald Barthelme says, go with the downer ending. So, like, he has a heart attack and dies. Anyway, it made me kind of think a lot about where the happy versus the sad endings. There's a lot of kind of bad stuff that happens. Like, he's so down and out. He hits rock bottom, you know, he loses the child, which is about the worst sense of dread. You know, I remember this movie mostly because of that.
Yeah.
When I watched it the first time.
The sequence, it's like, of him just kind of scrambling around the mall.
Yeah, like, mm-hmm. I felt that kind of panic. You know, I have my own children, so, like, you lose sight and you think possibly that they're lost. Like, that is, like, the worst feeling ever for a parent. And so I was really not looking forward to seeing that part again coming up. But, you know, and I don't even drink, but I kind of got the feeling, like, if you go to the bar, one, are you supposed to do that while you're babysitting? Are you supposed to bring the kid to the bar? Again, I'm not that familiar with how drinking works, but
it
seemed to me that that was not the best choice from the beginning.
It's not a good choice, and you can do that, but that sequence is a little bit odd how they shoot it, because they don't show him kind of making irresponsible decisions and drinking too much at the bar. He just kind of orders one, and then the kid's gone, and then we kind of learn that he...
I actually thought that was really wasted. Well done. Because,
really?
Because when he was in the corridor and a cop stops him and says, have you been drinking, sir? And he's like, well, I've had a drink, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, you kind of know that this is also the culmination of some of his drinking issues.
Yeah.
Not just, like, he was actually getting drunk there. He's just always been a little drunk for years.
And he carries that flask around with him. So maybe he just emptied that and needed a refill.
Maybe so. Who knows? Anyway, it was interesting to think about, like, why can't we have a happy ending? What is it about happy endings that make us so suspicious? Like, why can't he get together with her in the end and say, you know, we made it work and I forgive you. Like, why would that be so problematic? Like, it's like Donald Barthelme is telling Thomas Cobb, make it a downer ending. It's almost like it's more artistic to have a sad ending, a depressing ending. Is it because we really believe that life is so horrible that it's not realistic unless the movie also ends in a horrible way?
No, I don't think that a happy ending by itself is a bad thing. I think that the formula leading up to the happy ending is the bad thing. And when you can tell that you're going in that direction and then it just kind of deposits you there, then you resent it because you're kind of like, the struggle was all fake. What am I even watching if it's just sort of, if there's a sense of inevitability to it, then it's not a real person. Then this is a Hollywood story, not a human story. And I'm trying to think of a movie. I'm sure that there are dozens of happy endings out there, but I'm not thinking of one
out of the
right
million
now.
Movies, there's probably a dozen that were done really well with happy endings.
You know, I'm thinking about like Walk the Line and Ray Again, think, but we didn't like those.
I think Field of Dreams has a tremendously, you know, touching but very happy, positive ending. I don't know. I'm trying to think of movies that really
work. It's a Wonderful Life. Well. It's Christmas time.
It's a Wonderful Life also works so well. Like you believe the happy ending, but it's like depressing for like an hour and a half.
The movie's
like,
about suicide.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, yes, a Christmas movie. We're so happy. And this guy's just wrestling.
But I found I was
checking his own mortality.
I was kind of checking myself watching this. Like, did I resent the movie because it was going, it seemed like it was going to have like a too easy resolution? I mean, I don't know. What's the difference between a too easy resolution and just a happy ending?
There's nothing easy about the resolution in It's a Wonderful Life, though.
No.
And that is a very happy ending that you can almost well up at because it's like everything's
almost
coming together. I'm sure in the past, maybe the room's gotten dusty. but yeah, that's the kind of, it's almost corny. When people talk about Capra, it's like, oh, it's overly sweet because they're thinking about that scene where everyone's standing around, surrounded by friends and family, and we're singing. We're so happy and we're so unified that we're singing Christmas carols together. But really the rest of the movie does, it totally avoids that. So then when you get that punch at the end, it feels earned and it feels good. If the rest of the movie was just kind of, this guy's fallen on hard times. Oh, he's an alcoholic, but he licked it. Not a problem. He's out. He's recovered. Then the struggle is missing. And I think you need that struggle in order for it to really pan out.
So I thought a lot about slobs in this
slobs.
Movie. Slobs, yeah.
Okay.
Jeff Bridges, pretty big slob in this movie. He's got, and it made me think like, who are the best, my favorite slobs in recent movie history?
Favorite movie slobs.
So okay. You didn't, I know I'm a big fan of State of Play. Russell Crowe is a slob reporter.
Mm-hmm.
Great moment early on. You're first meeting him. He's eating Cheetos in his car as he's driving along. He finishes it up by shaking the bag above his mouth and they kind of scatter and bounce off. And then he kind of half crumples it and tosses it over his shoulder into his back seat. This is a great slob moment for Russell Crowe.
Yeah.
Philip Seymour Hoffman, great slob.
World-class slob.
Great slob. Yeah. Rumpled shirts galore in the set and Savages, for example.
Yeah.
Jeff Bridges in this movie, I mean, his pants are always undone.
Yep.
He's just lying around in his
and the
motel
dude,
room.
I mean,
and the dude.
Is there a more famous slob?
But the belt just draws so much attention to the fact, like, why not just take the belt off?
Yeah.
But he's got the belt dangling open, so like, hey, everyone, I'm so lazy that I don't want to buckle my pants up.
And just in case he has to, you know, get up and make himself presentable, you can buckle it back up. It's no big deal.
It's easy. The chain smoking and the constant alcohol kind of goes along with that.
Yeah.
Sam Rockwell, he's not quite so, he's not quite the lovable kind of overweight slob, but he's kind of like, I was thinking, of course, the greatest spitting out a moon pie scene in movie history in the Green Mile. And I just watched Moon recently from this year, from 2009. And he's got this like bleeding from the mouth, exhausted astronaut slob vibe going. But then of course I looked up timeout.com's list of the greatest slobs in movie history.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And some great ones.
All right.
Zach Galifianakis.
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Bill Murray. He's got some good slob moments. John Candy, Will Ferrell, Seth Rogen. You mentioned as top slobs. And then a kind of a questionable one to me.
Top slobs.
Ursula and the Little Mermaid. Does she count as like a slob? Or as my son calls her, the purple grandma?
The purple grandma. I don't know if she really does anything really slobby. I mean, she looks kind of slobby, but does she do anything slobby?
I don't know. I don't know. Certainly not in the category of the slobs that I just mentioned, but
no.
Anyway, I don't really have a, I guess I will ask you.
Who's my favorite?
Who's your favorite slob?
Yeah. Oh man. It's a great question. I mean the dude, I think I might have to say the dude on
He's
this one
classic.
and just keep it simple. I mean, Jeff Bridges plays a good slob here for sure, but I think I prefer the Lebowski slob.
The slobbiest slob of Jeff Bridges' career. He wins best picture. He wins best actor for this one.
Yeah, he should. You should get a different kind of gold statue, a slobby looking gold man somehow.
The Oscar with the belt undone could be the best slob. Any other questions?
Yeah, so I mentioned Rain, Walk the Line, which are full of ultra popular songs you know.
Mm-hmm.
So how do the original songs in this one performed by Bridges work for you in comparison to those? Because like I said, this is like a biopic. It's about a fake person, but I think it's totally fair to put it in that same group of musical biopics.
It sort of is. I mean, I think one of the problems that we've had with biopics over the past, 100 plus episodes is that there's this obligatory, we're going to include the moment when he was traumatized as a kid, mm-hmm. when he was, a angsty teenager and chasing his dream. That's not what they're doing in this movie. I mean, in a sense, I would say this actually is a much better version of biopic because it doesn't try to do that. It's like, this is when he's 57, period. And it's like a slice of life. We never see him in his glory days. And so in a way, I think that's what makes it kind of feel similar to The Wrestler.
Yeah.
That it's just like, it's an older guy who used to be on top of his game and now he's wrestling with his, his failures, I guess, and seeing what still drives him. But as far as the music, it really helps when you're hearing those famous songs from the biopics, from the real life ones, that you already know them. There's a kind of recognition, like, oh yeah, this is where that came from. It's almost like you're hearing this great fresh song for the first time.
Hmm.
With this one, I was kind of like, because I didn't know the song, it didn't really have that. And I never really, you never really heard it all the way through or like really understood like why some of the lyrics were, and I didn't really fully experience the song in this movie.
Really?
I didn't really feel
like I'm the opposite. I kind of think that knowing the songs being famous in Array or The Walk the Line, you almost have to reverse engineer the origin story to show us this is the emotional truth that inspired the song. Whereas here, it's kind of the songs just informed the character. The weary kind we heard in the trailer, but he also has that one funny how fallen feels like flying. And I think when you're talking slobs, I could see that, because this guy's just been falling probably for the last, I don't know how many years, mm-hmm. but he had some success out of it and, he fell until he hit rock bottom, but then he licked AA and no problems.
Just like
so
that.
Then he started flying again.
It only took him 11 steps.
Yeah, it was so easy. But also it reminded me of that movie Once that we saw a few years back with Glenn Hansard and Marketa Orlova. And it's real songs, original songs in that too, that you can see them actually playing and performing. And there's something I think about seeing the plucking and the strumming and the actual performance element of it. That kind of it gives something to the creation aspect, like we're seeing this song be built in real time, even though it's not. I think there's still that discovery element that we don't get in the famous ones.
Two other really great fictional but musician movies, That Thing You Do.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Seeing that song come to life is really fun. And Tom Hanks is great and a lot of people are, but and then Inside Llewelyn Davis, which again, I'm really looking forward
another
to revisiting
one
that one.
He's really performing. And yep. I think there are some original songs in that, right?
I think it's
been a while, but they might be all remember. Original.
My last question is really about the anything else?
Not for me.
A couple of things of trivia here. Bridges initially passed on the role. He said he liked the script, but he knew that the songs would make it or break it. And at the time there wasn't anyone who with musical chops to like actually make the songs. So then a year later he talked with T-Bone Burnett and they agreed to work on it together because Bridges knew that he had to have like a really great song come in with it. So I thought that was kind of interesting
mm-hmm.
and kind of shows the, obviously it worked cause it won the Oscar. But having, I don't know, there is something authentic about knowing like, hey, this is an original song made for this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And but makes sense that he kind of knew he had to team up with the right person to go forward. So keep it or kick it, Mike.
This might shock you. It's going to be another kick for me.
Yeah, it's a fairly easy kick for me as well. I did find some things I liked about it. Didn't have big problems, but it wasn't...
Yeah. On the Are you glad you saw it? Would you watch it again, scale? Yes, I'm glad I saw it because of Jeff Bridges. Mm-hmm. Like I said earlier, if he wasn't in this, I think I would be much more negative. But mm-hmm. he's just so good that I can watch him all day. If I would watch it again, I'm not so sure about that.
I probably wouldn't go out of my way to watch it again. Only when we go through, when we hit 2009 again, you know, some years down the future when we start back over on this list, then I guess we'll watch it then.
Yeah, makes sense.
In the next episode, we talk about an Education Best Picture nominee, Carey Mulligan's Coming Out Party, for which she earned an Oscar nomination for Best Actress.
Until then, find us on social media or wherever you listen. And for 16 years of Golden Takes, head over to letterboxd.com/Mike Cavalieri.
To support the show, visit patreon.com/bestpicturethis.
Thanks to WNZF and the illustrious Mark Gilliland for producing. Also, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe to the show.
Thanks for listening to Best Picture This, the conspicuously unbuckled belt of film criticism.